I go over some of those things with some students. I have a class where Rare Earth is one of the books we've taught. I've said to them before, I like, or I do sometimes go outside after studying that and think, wow, liquid water. It's an amazing fact that liquid water has been on the surface of the Earth for billions of years. But in Minnesota, there are months when you can't do this. So you have to go somewhere else. Okay, I'm going to talk about some research that I've been involved in the last couple of years, and it's a little bit unusual. So feel free to interrupt or ask a question. Now that I've been doing it for a while, it seems kind of obvious and natural to me. But if you haven't sort of done any research called something like counterfactual, then it may seem very strange at first. The specific thing that I've been working on is the subtitle there, Probing the Dependence of Chemistry on the Fundamental Constants. So if you're very familiar with fine-tuning investigations that we can call cosmological, astronomers and cosmologists and their fine-tuning investigations, we're doing something very similar in spirit in the domain of chemistry. So we can separate, I think, pretty clearly in this particular case, the facts from the interpretation. So the facts are that the dimensionality, laws, constants, initial conditions of our universe are fine-tuned for life. And probably everyone in this room can give dozens of sources related to this. And I'm not an astronomer, even though this is the astronomy section, so you may know lots more about those than I do. In the sense that, the second sentence here, small changes in many parameters would have made what appear to be obviously sterile universes. And by obviously sterile, we mean universes with no water at all, with no hydrogen remaining, with no stable burning stars, things like this. And here's a couple relevant quotes. This is a quotation from the physicist Max Tegmark, but Barrow has done a lot of the cataloging of all these things. Virtually no physical parameters can be changed by large amounts without causing radical changes to the physical world. There's a quote, a famous one from Hawking. If one considers the possible constants and laws that could have emerged, the odds against a universe that has produced life like ours are immense. Okay, so I give one example, even though I just said probably many of you are familiar with it, because I want to say that the research that I'm doing is very similar in spirit to this type of work. So what happens if you change the nuclear strong force? You just wonder, what if the nuclear strong force were different? Well, if it were weaker, deuterium is unbound, which is bad news for our universe. Without deuterium, the route to helium formation and star formation is cut off, so we have no stars or stable energy sources generally. If you make it a little stronger, then the diproton, or helium-2, becomes stable. I had never thought about this before as a chemist until the last few years. Isn't it an amazing effect that the strong nuclear force is just strong enough to bind a proton and a neutron, or just weak enough to not bind two protons? So the strong force cannot overcome the electrostatic repulsion of two protons. So what if the force were stronger? Well, there'd be no hydrogen remaining in the universe because all the protons would have met up if you changed the rules at the beginning of the universe, or if you flip the switch live now, then the sun would burn I think it's something like 10 to the 18th times faster for a few percent. So the sun would burn or explode instantly. All right, so those have been cataloged. There are many examples of that kind of cosmological fine-tuning. There are good reasons for believing that complex beings like us should exist in three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. And I'm not going to go into that right now. Within that constraint, how else can we generate other types of universes? The most obvious thing to do is change the physical constants, which is what the cosmologists have been doing. We don't know for sure, of course, what the physical constants are, because we don't have a theory of everything. They might be constant-free parameters. It could be there is no better theory of everything than a model with 27 parameters, give or take a few with advancements of theory. Perhaps this seems to be becoming more and more common. The physical constants are determined by some sort of probability distribution. So there's a large number of universes, And the theory of everything tells you the probability of getting different constants. Or perhaps the physical constants that we see are the result of some sort of random symmetry breaking event. So they are produced by the history of our early universe. All right, here is a line of argument in a Tegmark article in which he proposes a kind of a bizarre theory of everything that I may have time to get back to in a minute. Barrow and others have also argued that there are chemical properties that are necessary for life. So one is that solid water floats. That's a very unusual property that chemists know and love. I mean, everybody knows it, but chemists think it's one of these neat, unique things we teach our students. Most things aren't like this. Solids are more dense than liquids, right? Except for water. So for ice, we have fish. Even in Minnesota, you know, I say there's no liquid water, but you can go ice fishing. Sorry, I haven't taken this up yet, but you can ice fish in Minnesota. So what if complex life requires liquid water to have a point of maximum density at 4 degrees Celsius? And the chemistry of our universe is determined by about two parameters that I'll talk about in a minute. But those two parameters are already fixed by the requirements of things like stable burning stars. It seems that there may be more requirements, it looks like anyway, at first glance, there are more requirements for life than there are parameters that define it. And what does this mean? Tegmark is not a Christian, but he presents this line of argument and suggests that it means one of two things. Well, two categories of things, I guess. The first is that there's some sort of God or life force. So you could believe that the whole thing, not just these two constants randomly assigned, but the whole thing is designed to produce life. Perhaps you could also hold to some kind of strong anthropic principle where the universe must produce life in order to exist. Or, this is the second point, and many would probably hold to this at this point. These other constraints, like that ice floats, they look like they're necessary for intelligent beings like us, but they're not really necessary. If you had a different universe where water did not have these properties, then you could have complex life in those universes as well. Okay, so this launches the ultimate, what I call the ultimate habitability quest. I don't pretend that this quest is that I've accomplished this or that maybe anyone ever will, but we're going to learn more about it. So Tegmark speculates there could be a large number of tiny islands of habitability containing life forms which would simply evolve by combining chemical elements in a manner different from ours. Now, by islands here, I just want to emphasize, he doesn't mean galaxies, right? He doesn't mean that you could get in a spaceship and fly to these places, but that there are other universes with other values of the physical constants that are habitable. So many of them are clearly not habitable, but there are other ones that are habitable, and at least we can say it would make him feel better if there are a large number of these habitable ones out there. And here's a quotation from Barrow that's calling for something similar. We need to know all those constants of nature whose values provide necessary conditions for the existence of observers. And so this call can be addressed, I think, to some extent within the facts category. Without going into the interpretation of the facts, what do we need for life? Well, what do we need for life? Well, what do we need for life in our universe? So this is trying to bridge this connection between the cosmological constraints and the chemistry that those same parameters provide for us that we use for life. All right, so first of all, it's an amazing fact that only the electromagnetic force really matters very much in chemistry. So you don't have to worry about the gravity between electron and proton. You can calculate it for fun. But you can also treat nuclei as point charges. It works very, very well. So you don't need the strong nuclear force. You don't need, unless you're doing radioactive decay or something, don't need the weak force, don't need gravity, you only need the electromagnetic force. The effects of relativity are small, and this is very interesting in regards to the question of what kind of universes could support life. And by that I mean for atoms that are the key to organic chemistry and biochemistry, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, you can completely ignore the effects of relativity and the errors when you do quantum chemistry calculations are minuscule. Okay, now I don't have a lot of time. I realize that there are heavier elements that are in enzymes, and there are places in the periodic table where you have to take account of relativity. But it's still clear that the main scaffolding of organic chemistry and biochemistry is built on these elements. And I'll come back to alpha and beta and what they are in a minute, but this means our constant alpha is about zero. And the second, which we also teach our general chemistry students, is that electrons are much, much lighter than nuclei. So that means they move much, much faster, at least if we can pretend they're classical for the minute. They move around much faster than the nuclei do. And this means that biochemistry is very well described by the non-relativistic Schrodinger equation. So the equation's been around since the 30s. This is my area of expertise is in electronic structure theory, computational quantum chemistry. So my expertise is not in astronomy, but in studying molecules using the Schrodinger equation. Okay, so what are the parameters then, if we accept that? What are the parameters that determine what biochemistry is like from a fundamental perspective? Well, the first is beta, the electron-proton mass ratio. There's the number. I tell my students, this is a good ballpark number to have in your head, 1,800, and they ignore me. They never remember. But this means that in quantum chemistry, use what we call the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. You can call sometimes referred to as a flies on an ox approximation. So no matter what the ox does, the flies are always in equilibrium around the ox, because the flies move so much faster than the ox does. Now, why am I bringing this up? Well, this is actually the basis of all molecular structure. So think of a DNA double helix. You just use the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. Because you just pictured in your head, probably, that's fair to say, you just pictured in your head a bunch of nuclei, and you believe that those nuclei only undergo small amplitude vibrations away from that equilibrium spot. So, you know, somebody might say, well, you know, a real helix is moving a little bit, and you'd say, yeah, of course it is, but still, more or less, that's its shape, right? And the electrons are delocalized. Well, that's okay. Still, more or less, that's where the nuclei are. Now, imagine that beta, which is a small number there, were larger than it is. So in the sort of extreme case would be beta is 1. So if beta is 1, electrons and nuclei have equal mass, so they are equally delocalized. So now those of us who are chemists, our brains will start to misfire, because we can't think about chemistry like this, but the physicists would probably do better. Now your nuclei will be spread out all over your molecule, probably in quotation marks, just like your electrons are. And so you have a murky quantum soup of particles in which it's difficult to imagine you could really even have information. I don't know that anybody's really seriously tried to look into that question. And you could also go the other way, fascinating enough, as if beta were much larger than 1, then your nuclei would get delocalized all over the molecule, and your electrons would be localized in space. And then my brain starts to hurt, because you'd still have, anyway, we'll move on. So molecular structures based on beta is small. Right? Here's the fine structure constant. Unfortunately, it's harder to understand what it is. There are many different ways of looking at it. It's the reciprocal of the speed of light. So a small alpha is equivalent to a very high speed of light. It turns out light's very fast, right? So alpha is very small. If you want to know what the value is, if you take the energy it takes to bring two electrons together to a certain distance. So you take the energy that it takes to do that, you divide it by the energy of a photon with that wavelength, that's the number. So there are many ways of looking at it. It comes out of spectroscopy. It's if you do spectroscopy of atoms, this is something that you observe. There are lots of funny stories about the discovery or of the values of these constants. Arthur Eddington was convinced that alpha must be exactly 1 divided by 136. And he had this elaborate explanation of why it had to be 136. And then it turned out it was closer to 137. And then so there was a new story about why it had to be 137. And eventually it became clear that it was just a number. It was just a number like that. And that has inspired searches for more fundamental theories that might explain why. Why do you, you get a fine structure constant with that value instead of some other value? All right, in chemistry, relativistic effects scale as the product of the fine structure constant and Z. This is the atomic number, which gets larger as you go down the periodic table. So what that means is that in chemistry, those elements for which relativity matters are at the bottom of the table. So if you want to study uranium, you have to use relativity or you get completely the wrong answer. But if you want to study carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, you can ignore it. All right, so if alpha is bigger, what happens is that those elements that are at the top of the periodic table become what we call relativistic elements. They start to behave differently. And there are some, not quite back of the envelope, but there are some straightforward extrapolations that you can do that suggest that if alpha is as large as about 0.2, you get no bonding, no chemical bonding at all. So this number came from, for example, if you calculate the relativistic correction to the energy of carbon dioxide at a level about 0.2, the correction is larger than the total binding energy of the carbon dioxide molecule. So we'll see some more in our results. I'll show you some more examples of that. Okay, so a note about the cosmological fine-tuning. So there are already reasons out there given that show that these parameters are fine-tuned. All right, I'm not trying to replace those or supersede those. And in fact, we'll see that the chemical constraints are much weaker than the physical constraints. Physics is much more difficult. It turns out to get things that look pretty simple, like galaxies and stars, to operate right, turns out to be harder than to at least get simple, stable molecules. All right, so stable protons, the existence of a grand unified theory on the right energy scale, long-lived stars, these have already produced boundaries like this. But that's not what I'm going to do. All right, so I'll skip that slide. So at this point, I'm going to show you some results that I've gotten over the last, year or year and a half. And I'm not going to go through the different curves. So you can just look at the general trend if you care. The best answer is the one that has that acronym. So what happens as alpha gets bigger? Well, this is the bond angle of a water molecule. So just take a regular water molecule, increase alpha, and let's talk about the scale here. All right, so the x scale 0 means alpha is 0. This is the non-relativistic limit. So in the universe before Dirac, there was no relativistic quantum mechanics. This was the best you could do. If you ignore relativity, this is the answer you get. So we should get a bond angle for water of about 105 degrees. Depends on your method, but that's the right answer. All right. Now, for the x scale I'm using here, I need to explain this alpha over alpha naught. Alpha naught is the natural observed value. So an alpha over alpha naught of 1 is our universe. All right. So this is the non-relativistic answer. Yeah, this is the non-relativistic answer. Right there is our universe. And so as I said before, we're very close to the non-relativistic limit. You can ignore relativity, and you get about the same answer.
What
yes?
is the measured value of that angle?
Well, I mean, the chemists will say it's 105.9. But we're not trying to calculate and get this value exactly right here. In fact, the water molecule has been very precisely calculated. So if you wanted to get exactly the right answer for the bond angle of water, you can do it. But right now, we're focused on trends. But this is about right. It's 105 degrees. All right, so this is the non-relativistic limit. This is our universe, and this is the bond angle of water as alpha gets larger. Now, I said before a value of about 0.2 should prevent all bonding, so I should say, probably to be fair, that we already knew that once this number got to about 28, a scaling of alpha of about 28 times, there would not be stable molecules. But we may see breakdowns before that. All right, so the bond angle goes down. Maybe this is a hint that, for those of you who are a chemist, that the oxygen is acting like a lower period element a little bit. This is the bond length on the right. The bond length's getting a little bit larger. Okay, here's what happens when the electron mass increases. It turns out that chemistry is less sensitive to this. I think, a little surprisingly to those of us who did it, it's turned out that chemistry is less sensitive to the electron mass. And again, this is a scaling of beta. So this probably should be, I have to think about that limit. Yeah, I think this is okay. I think this is assuming that the motions of the electrons and nuclei are completely separable. But this is our universe, which is just at one. Again, a value of one is our universe. But you have to go up to see a significant change in the bond angle of, I don't know, say 2 degrees. You've got to increase the mass of the electron almost 100 times, which I think is surprising. And the trends are the other directions. All right, so we are in uncharted waters because now we're studying the chemistry in other universes, right? So we can study anything we want to, and no one's ever done it before because no one's ever been in these universes. All right, so what happens to the binding energy of water? We know water is important for life, so it's a nice place to look, although water, macroscopic water is very difficult, very, very difficult to understand. Water dimer is very simple. So we take two water molecules and put them together. This is the binding energy. This is the non-relativistic energy. I like to think in kilocalories per mole. But as the fine structure constant increases, the binding of one water molecule for another water molecule decreases. Well, how much matters? Well, it turns out that we can't say for sure because nobody can completely model the properties of water. It's a very complicated substance involving a fine balance between entropy and energy. But here are some ideas. These are some numbers taken from an article written by Martin Chaplin, and he was not studying doing calculations of other universes, but he was arguing from the properties of our universe, like water with other solvents or ions in it, D2O versus H2O, some chemical properties, how the hydrogen bond strength might affect different properties. So these are just some of them that he tried to estimate. So if the hydrogen bond strength of water were 29% lower, then water would boil at 15 degrees Celsius, which is, I would think, pretty extreme change. Here's an argument about proteins denaturing, a very, very complicated topic because then you have the interactions interior and exterior. Potassium becomes cosmotropic. What this means for, if there are any biologists here, people study cells, this means that the behavior of sodium ion and potassium ion would become similar. Their attraction to water relative to water's attraction to water would become similar to each other instead of being different. And you can't produce potassium and sodium cell potentials in the same way that our cells do. This is a really geeky chemist example. PKW, so that just determines how many ions are in water. Carbon dioxide solubility is an extreme change. And this is one that everybody would like to know if you could make it rigorous. Chaplin suggests that only a 2% decrease in the hydrogen bonding strength would be enough to completely wipe out the liquid density maximum at 4 degrees Celsius. And what that means is just that the freezing temperature has come up and it's met that temperature of maximum density. Okay. Here's a qualitative study I did of some different bond strengths. So chemists like to look at these things, comparing the average strength of one bond to the average strength of another one. And you can see that just generally they go down. The larger the fine structure constant is, the weaker the bonding. Here's a fun little spot. If we have any organic chemists in the audience, there's a point at which the strength of an OH bond and the strength of a CH bond, which often can compete in a chemical reaction, crossover. And so that would be a paradigm shift for organic chemists. So these are the kinds of things that we're looking at. So what is chemistry like? How does carbon hold up? Does carbon form long chains and branch chains and chains and rings? And the short answer for carbon is it holds up pretty well. This is the percent drop in the strength. Looks like we had some symbol conversion problem there. This is the percent drop in the strength of these bonds, carbon-carbon, carbon-carbon double bond, carbon-hydrogen bonds. As the fine structure constant is increased, it was supposed to stay at the top of the slide to 14 times its natural value. So this is a large change. Benzene holds up. Pi D localization holds up. The stability order of radicals. For the chemists, your tertiary, secondary, primary that you teach in organic chemistry still holds up. The ozone equilibrium holds up. I was looking at the relative energy of these isomers, which might be relevant to atmosphere and UV protection, of course. Okay, let me go to the next one. All right, so what doesn't? Here are some things that appear to be sensitive. Homolytic bond breakage. It turns out that in these universes with more alpha, you do better to homolytic bond breakage means you break a bond, but each fragment gets one of the electrons. So you break a bond equally. And this turns out to be much easier, I should say, in these universes with a larger fine structure constant. So the as alpha gets large, if you want to pull fluorine, suppose you just want to pull fluorine off, separating the electrons evenly, that becomes 39% easier or less energy. One thing that jumped out right away is that water and carbon dioxide appear to be particularly unstable as the fine structure gets larger. And I don't have a real good explanation of that. But this causes energies of combustion to be much smaller. So the energy that you get when you burn butane goes down 40% over this range. And then there are some more subtle changes. Now, you might think that one way to use this kind of research, if you wanted to be really creative and think outside the box, is to try to find some mechanism, say, of prebiotic synthesis that only works with our values of the fundamental constant. And with some certain assumptions, you might take that as a hint that this step did play a role. Anyway, so that's kind of wild speculation. But there was a paper published in Astrobiology in 2007, prebiotic synthesis of adenine. So these authors, I was not involved in this work, but these authors mapped out some steps that they thought were plausible for a way that HCNs could come together and make adenine. Well, we can sort of one-up that. We can study the energy of those isomers, and then we can do the same thing in other universes or with other values of the physical constants. And I don't know what this means exactly. But it seems that as the fine structure constant is larger, there would be less of a driving force to produce that product. Okay, I need to acknowledge my collaborators and quit because I've run out of time. So I've been working with Wesley Allen and Fritz Schaefer at the University of Georgia. Ali Siddiqui is a graduate student at the University of Georgia who did the majority of the electron-proton mass variation. Taylor Mock was an undergraduate who did the adenine work and is now at Virginia Tech. And some of the work, anyway, was funded by the Templeton Foundation. And I will stop there before I get into what it means too much, because I've run out of time. Thank you. Yes, please.
I'm assuming you chose these particular parameters because they're the easiest. Did you go to, like, you go into a program like Gaussian or some Shaper stuff and go to the data block and the fundamental constants and tweak it?
Essentially what we did. Yeah, right. So, I don't want to make it sound too easy, but we used the conventional tools of computational quantum chemistry. So a program, we didn't use Gaussian, but a program similar to Gaussian. All of these calculations were done with the Psi program package, which is only Unix based, but it's open source. I develop it with other Schaefer students.
One last question, I'll let someone else have a shot.
Sure.
It seems like the most critical parameter in terms of chemistry theory would be the electrostatic attractions. Am I correct that the reason you can't play around with the electrostatic force and charge, you can't play around with that, is because you completely change the Robot-Hall equations and these programs will collapse?
When we write the Schrodinger equation in what we call atomic units, then the solution is independent of the definition of the meter, or I don't have the slides with me. Okay, so this gets into are you changing scaled unitless. Oh, 1 over R.
1 over R.
Right. So I addressed that huge topic in about one sentence because other people have done it first. It doesn't seem anything else really works very well. I mean, we could do something really ad hoc, but if the universe has more than three spatial dimensions, or you try to use 1 over R squared, you don't get stable orbits. Or stable solution. This goes all the way back to, I mean, there's a long history of classical and quantum. Ehrenfest showed in three spatial dimensions there's no solution, no stable orbits for a Coulomb potential. And at first. I don't think it's going to work. I haven't thought about 1 over R 1.001. But
it comes from the dimension earlier.
Yeah.
Reality.
Well, it doesn't fit with.
You have to change your whole radius of the circumference.
It comes
from
the
three-dimensional.
You can't put it slot in.
Well, if the force, what's the force? If the force is the electrostatic force, then. Barrow has summarized those arguments, but it seems at first glance that there's lots of different ways you could change the equations, but there are pretty good arguments to think that only these two parameters are going to define your chemistry. Joe?
Some young Earth arguments have appealed the possibility that the speed of light has changed over time. This would pretty much argue against that, is it?
Yes, I suppose so. Although, you know, the way to address that is direct astronomical measurements. So there is a question of, are the constants constant in our universe even? And astronomers are working very hard on the spectroscopy of distant stars. And I've got a big article about that in the bag, and it seems in my bag here. But it seems to, so far anyway, to within a part per million, 10^-5, 10^-6, they have not. So there are, I guess, some physical theories that suggest that they may, that the constants, the apparent constants, may actually have changed in the history of our universe. But they appear, at least over billions of years, not to have changed more than 10^-5. Or so. Yeah, okay.
Question.
I'll take one more.
It's been a while, but I recall Planck structure constant is basically derived from the ratio of electron mass, electron charge,
E squared over H plus C doesn't have an mass in there.
In atomic units, it's 1 over the speed of light squared.
No.
1 over speed of light.
The hydrogen bond
yes?
strength change and tweak fine circuit. Because hydrogen bonds are so integral to anything that's going to call light.
Yes? Yes?
And if you get to very fine. Balancing interplay between all the functions are available. Is anything that you've looked at, you know, something else? I find it very fascinating.
The hydrogen bond strength of water?
Well, hydrogen bonds are involved in all protein structures.
Yeah. I mean, the only data.
Very weak bond, and the function of
yes.
it is very weak.
Yes.
So it's a very delicate balance, even in our present world. How much.
So the only data I have is on hydrogen bonding. The only data that I have is for the water dimer, which I showed you, and that suggests that the fine structure constant, which is small, probably could only be raised by a few factors. I mean, maybe 3 times, maybe 4 times, and then. But I suspect things are going to break down that we count on are going to break down much faster than that, but I can't prove it. Okay, thank you.